It's Sunday, November 1st, and you are listening to Peanuts and Popcorn. P&P is a spontaneous podcast between two old friends on baseball and motion pictures. I'm Tom Hockney.
And I'm Leo Fontana. This week on Peanuts and Popcorn, the World Series is over, and the Los Angeles Dodgers are world champions. Dave Roberts joins a very exclusive club, and Justin Turner behaves irresponsibly. The White Sox hire Tony La Russa, and the Tigers bring in A.J. Hinch. Will the Red Sox bring back Alex Cora? Does new owner Steve Cohen make the Mets a better team? We'll marvel at the lack of shifts against DJ LeMahieu, and we'll talk scoreboard watching in San Diego. We'll bring you up to speed with the Cubs, and our popcorn segment is on the Federico Fellini film, La Dolce Vita. Como va? Como va? Tom, como how va? You doing?
Happy Halloween to you as well. I'm once again, I'm hanging in there. I'm scared because of the amount of COVID infections. Yeah. And basically, you know, we're garrisoned inside of this house.
Yeah. I completely understand. It is really, really hard undergoing Halloween when you have children and you can't let them do all the things that they're accustomed to doing. It's right. Really, really hard over here.
Yeah. So tell me about that. What's going on?
We did get together with some kids down the block, not many of them. You know, these are kids who go to the same school as my kids. They're our neighbors. And we got together and we set up a movie screen outside with some space heaters and blankets. And we just watch movies. And, you know, we serve some food and we gave out some candy. We had a little candy outside. We did get some trick-or-treaters. I had a big bowl. And what I'd done is I'd taken individual baggies, Ziploc baggies, the snack size, and I'd throw in three pieces of candy, zip it up, put it in the, so that's what I did.
I talk about Andersonville all the time. It's my favorite neighborhood in Chicago. Yeah. Some of the families got extremely creative as far as how they are dispersing the candy. And the best one that I saw was literally a plastic tube from a second floor that went all the way down to the street level, and it actually was propped up by this like column, and it shot candy at the kids, and the kids were loving it. They absolutely loved it. And I saw other ones where they had candy on a line, like clothes hanging on a line, like you said, with individual bags, and you just, you know, take them off.
Repel them down or whatever. Right.
What I didn't see, because again, if I was a kid, and if this was when I was a child doing this, first of all, I would have taken a lot more than just one. That's the problem. Yeah. It's like, are the kids behaving? And so when you're showing this film, how do you get these children to sit there and watch any film, let alone a series of films? I'll hang up and listen for my answer.
No, well, basically, the kids got to determine what they wanted to watch. You know, that new movie based on the Roald Dahl novel, Witches, I think.
Oh, yeah, okay. On,
so they watched that.
Was that with Bette Midler?
Yeah, no, the no, one
no,
that...
No, no, sorry, no, no. sorry. I kid.
But the new one that just came out with Anne Hathaway, and so the kids kind of determined what they wanted to watch. I'm not going to make them watch The Shining, you know what I mean?
Or Carnival of Souls.
So what I did was, but the adults went somewhere else, and we hung out and talked and ate food and drank beer, and, you know, But, you know, this is a podcast dedicated. We always begin with baseball, but then we end with movies. And the movie world, the cinema world, lost a giant, a titan, in that Sean Connery passed away at the age of 90. Yeah. And I think he died in the Bahamas.
I'm not exactly sure.
I think he died in the Bahamas or in Bermuda, one of the two. He had a place there, or that's where he went to retire and live out his final years. And that's where he died.
I just know that he had to be cared for over the last 3 or 4 years. We're not, you know, he was in decline. You know, this is an icon from my childhood. And I never met in my entire life an honest heterosexual woman that didn't say he was maybe the hottest thing that they'd ever seen.
Dude, you're absolutely right. He is a man. He is a man's man. He was a man's man.
Yeah, but women were extremely attracted to him. So when you have somebody like that, that's actually loved by both men and women, He just was so iconic that while there were other James Bonds after him,
he was,
and some were good. I mean, the movie, that movie Casino comes to mind that was just done. That was a really good James Bond film, but nothing can replicate that string from the early 60s of Sean Connery as James Bond. It started with Dr. No, and my personal favorite, which I think was a third or fourth entry, was Goldfinger.
Goldfinger is a great choice for your favorite, but my favorite for my money, From Russia with Love.
Yeah, that's the second one. That is a great one too, and you can't go wrong. And Dr. No was great too, because Dr. it introduces the character. You can't really watch a James, if you're in a James Bond, you have to see Dr. No, and you should see it early on, just to get the flavor of what they were trying to do, which basically was, you know, this incredible young agent that had a lot of tools at his disposal, drove great cars, had, you know, guns that did things that guns weren't supposed to do.
Slept with beautiful women, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, so.
But see, the thing that I love about From Russia with Love is the Bond woman in that movie, Daniela Bianchi, is, I think, the sexiest one of all. That's the one that when I see her, I turn to jello.
Yeah, see, I was preferential to Pussy Galore, Honor Blackman.
Galore is also
Honor Blackman. She just passed away too. She was that, like, one of the first MILFs I ever saw.
Really was.
You know, he had an incredible life. And the other thing that you want to talk about is the fact that he had a very poor upbringing. My brother sent me a thing yesterday saying, hey, this is what my childhood was like. Basically, Sean Connery slept inside of a drawer, a dresser drawer, because there were so many kids in the house, which was similar to our house. So, but he won an Oscar. This guy was not just a fluffy superhero guy. He actually had acting chops, and that was proven when he won an Oscar for The Untouchables.
The Untouchables.
Playing a Chicagoan.
Yeah, which is a great role in a movie that is a Chicago movie, a great Chicago movie. But one of my favorite movies that has Connery in it, did you ever see Time Bandits?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And he makes an appearance at the end as the fireman, who's kind of like a father figure to the boy who's essentially an orphan.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite little moment, you know, that a lot of people forget that movie, a very sweet movie, and that's a very sweet scene with him. You know.
Yeah, well, that same director, I think, did Brazil, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he did. Well, it was Terry Gilliam.
And there's a great scene where Robert De Niro just shows up out of the blue in that film going, hey, I'm just here to fix the pipes. and that was his only line in the movie, really. It's sad to see him going and you know, because he does represent Chicago at a certain level. And I don't know that he would recognize the modern Chicago today. There's stuff that's been going on in our city related to looting and to other types of behavior that are...
To be discussed. We have to recognize that they're going on. And six people have been arrested in Chicago for paintball attacks. They drive around the city and they shoot guys with paintball guns. And this is a terrible, terrible thing. They caught six of them. I hope these people were prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
I think they will, so that this doesn't become like kind of a thing. Yeah. But, you know, I'm from Detroit. You don't kind of shoot somebody. And so, you know, paintballs are, even though it has taken, somebody's actually lost an eye over this. But the reality is it's not going to kill you. But it really certainly could piss you off in a Billy Jack kind of way. That's what concerns me the most, is that the retaliation factor. You don't mess around with shit like that. That's what I learned in Detroit. You don't kind of shoot somebody because they'll kind of kill you in return.
But it's kind of, you know, and worst of all, if you're not expecting a paintball attack, it's humiliating. It is a humiliating thing to
experience. True.
So anyway, so please, thank you for our law enforcement officials for putting a stop to this. I hope everybody is caught. One thing I do want to touch on, and that's something you mentioned, and that's the veracity of polling and what we're seeing and hearing at this point.
So as we kind of, hurtle towards the finish line here on Tuesday, there's been a series of articles that the great Nate Silver has written over the last week or so, basically saying, let's talk about the 2016 polls at this point right. in the election season versus the 2020 ones, and how were a lot of polls in 2016 so wrong. And so, and basically Nate's position is they weren't really that wrong. They were within the margin of error. And what's different about now, because a lot of Democrats are in panic mode that, hey, the map looks almost identical to what it did in 2016 at this time, there's some huge differences. And Silver points out that not only is Biden's lead, if you applied the same 2016 criteria, Biden is still ahead because he's beyond the error, the 3%, the margin of error.
Well, yeah, and moreover, he's also beyond 50%. He's above 50%.
Correct, in those key battleground states, yes.
And Clinton was not. I mean, she had a lead, but she was...
He was 46. Yes.
She wasn't, and she didn't get the undecideds. And that was the primary issue, I think, with Clinton, and it's something that they didn't recognize, is that, you know, she wasn't going to persuade a lot of new voters. She'd right. been around a long time. People have made up their mind about Hillary Clinton. Yeah. It's just not something that people are going to consider again. And so if they weren't already with her, they weren't ever going to be with her.
Well, Silver says that there was a tell in that polling data. Whenever you see anything close to 15% undecided with 2 or 3 weeks left in election, tells you that you have two unlikable candidates.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just Trump that was unlikable, who was extremely unlikable. It was Hillary Clinton was unlikable. And like right now, the undecided is like 3%. The real undecided is only 3%. And according to Silver, that's traditional. That's the way it's supposed to be. 2016 was an outlier and it was an aberration. And even though some things look the same, they're not the same.
Right. And I also, and again, I really believe that undecideds will break for Trump, you know, at like a 7 or 8 to 1. Clip. He's going to get most of the undecideds.
No, that's not true. According to Silver, that's not true. Biden is still, they're both getting it, but Biden is getting his at the same rate that he leads in the actual polls. It's not all going to Trump. But the point is, those voters, whatever you want to call them, have already made up their mind. So yeah. That's captured in the Biden and Trump vote now. The undecided vote is very small, which you would think that you would know what you were doing here on November 1st or October 30th or whenever they gather that polling data. That and the fact that the polls in the Midwest are much more, more of them and late into the season. Like in 2016, some of those polls were from like October 15th. Now that the polls are, you know, from yesterday.
Yesterday. And they're also, the big difference too is they're more finely calibrated. You know what I mean? They're more... The sample sizes, they're getting are more representative, they're more accurate. They after 2016, they made an effort to become more precise in that regard and to account for things that they had not accounted for back then.
Go out and vote, and let's get to Around the League, my friend.
Yes, Around the League, and we'll begin with the Los Angeles Dodgers. I got verklempt. But the Los Angeles Dodgers are the 2020 world champions. Congratulations to them, I guess. The Dodgers are probably one of my least favorite teams. This particular team, probably more so than any. I did not want them to win. I rooted against them actively and have for many years. But, oh, well, there it is.
You know, the funny thing is that last Sunday we did our show after the Rays had come back to one of the great finishes in World Series history to even that series.
Yeah.
And then the Dodgers just basically came out and
they took a couple shots, but you know, the Rays took a couple shots, but the Dodgers basically grabbed them, wrestled them to the ground and rubbed their faces in the dirt.
Yeah. And it was everything that we talked about kind of all season long, in the sense that the Dodgers were such a behemoth in the league. They really had it all as far as a team goes. The only question was, which is stuff that we covered, was, you know, was Kershaw going to melt in the postseason? No, he didn't. Who was going to be the MVP? It turns out it was Corey Seager. But after the weekend, as it moved on, To me, the Dodgers did what they did pretty much all season long. They quietly killed you. And there were some things, like, I want to talk about, you know, what Cash did, the Tampa Bay manager did in the sixth game or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, he was criticized heavily for taking, I think, Blake Snell out.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Out early in the game, I think in only like the fourth inning.
No, it was a little later than that. I was zooming live with my brother, and he's like, "This is the biggest mistake ever," only because Snell had at one point tied Sandy Koufax for the most strikeouts in a World Series game by having seven within two or three innings.
And he takes him out. Yeah.
Yeah, but the reason why, in Cash's defense, it was the third time through the lineup, and it had shown, and it is true with Snell, that it's always been a problem for him. If there is a problem, it's that third time. So he was playing the hunches. It did not work out. However, Cash, this is a career-making move. Because, first of all, you lost the last game. You have the whole offseason to think about it. You'll be criticized, and you are being criticized immensely. In his defense, I think he was playing hunches, and he went with his gut. And it just bit him. So maybe it would have worked out perfectly. In this case, it didn't.
He managed that game exactly the same way he's managed every single game this year, you know, and going right to his bullpen and going early.
True.
Getting these guys in.
Because they don't have starters.
I mean, I have to give him credit for dying with the strategy that got him here.
Correct.
You know what I mean? But you're right. I can't imagine that he would just have somebody ready to come in and just keep going with Snell to see how far he could get with him. I mean, outs are important. He's getting outs. Allow him to continue to try to get outs. You know, it doesn't mean if you let him face one hitter in the fifth or sixth inning that he's going to, that you're going to lose the game. You know,
the guy they brought in, Anderson, has a lively arm, but he'd had a dicey week and a half in the playoffs, including one blow up. And then another fairly decent outing, and then here's another blow up again. And the other thing, too, this is Sparky 101. Cash, you should have realized much sooner that you made the mistake than you did. You left him in. I would have been like, oh, you can't get the first guy out? You're out. This is the last game for us. I'll throw every pitcher we have. He did not take on that mentality, and I would have.
Well, I think he will be criticized, and he has been criticized. But he also manages in Tampa Bay. He doesn't manage in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles. And I think that most Tampa Bay fans, if you're really like a diehard Tampa Bay fan, I love the Rays, man. You know, you're probably just happy he got your team to the big dance.
You got some ex New Yorkers that live in the Tampa Bay area.
Many of them. It's not a big fan base.
That's true. And they all speak really loud because they're old and have hearing issues.
The Tampa Bay Ray fan base is smaller than the Chicago White Sox. It is smaller than the Reds.
Oh no, for sure. It's extremely small. That no one is talking about that. It's just in the court of public opinion, which is not just in Tampa anymore because of Twitter and other things. You know, he's taking some hits, but
I guarantee you that they won't remember him for the mistake. He'll be remembered for getting that plucky little team all the way to the sixth game of the World Series.
Yes.
So talking about managers, I do want to mention that there's one thing about the Dodgers winning the World Championship that did make me happy, and that was Dave Roberts joining Cito Gaston. And this is to just say this out loud kind of infuriates me. He becomes only the second African-American manager to win a World Series. And is that just amazing?
Well, there's only been, I think, four or five that have been in the World Series.
Dusty Baker.
And who was the manager of the Texas Rangers in 2011?
Oh, yeah, Washington.
Yeah. Ron Washington.
Ron Washington, yeah.
But Cito Gaston, if you read that article, it really kind of talks about when he was a hitting coach for Toronto. He basically was a Toronto guy because he came along with, I think, Bobby Cox.
Organization man, dignified. You know, people.
Or was it Jimmy? It was either Jimmy Williams or Bobby Cox that he was basically his guy.
Yeah,
and And Gaston, you know, graduated all the way to becoming a manager. And then actually at that point, the Blue Jays were a juggernaut.
They were a juggernaut. He got a great team and he took that team to two World Series.
And he made all the right moves and he was the very first. And he certainly is, you know, his place in baseball is established. But they talk about when they lost that playoffs to the Kansas City Royals in 85, Gaston didn't leave his basement for a week.
Yeah, it was a bitter loss.
Yeah, I mean, extremely.
And he was saying, too, in this article by, what's her name, Rhiannon.
Doesn't matter. But yeah.
Rhiannon Walker of The Athletic. She talks about how, you know, he had experienced this just terrible loss, and he understood how Dave Roberts felt having lost, you know, getting to the World Series so many times, that he really appreciated that. Felt, although he doesn't know Roberts and has never spoken to him.
Right, also, right. And he hopes to, and you know, once this COVID business settles down, you know, it'd be nice to see those two guys together, because Robert certainly had a much tougher road, in my opinion, than Gaston did, because Gaston did, you know, did not play in the spotlight like Roberts has done. And Roberts has had some things thrown at him, like the Houston asterisk whole situation.
That are unfair, patently unfair. Well,
but completely out of his control. Yeah. And so... it's congratulations to him. You know, I do, before we move on, I do want to mention the fact that the Dodgers, you know, getting to this point has taken a lot of money and great organizational
efforts, you know, sort of discipline and commitment. That's true.
Yeah. And so I sent you a 538 article where they kind of talk about the fact that when teams have really great farm systems, they normally don't have the biggest payroll.
No, they don't.
And the Dodgers, a couple of different times, have had the best farm system, but also baseball's highest payroll. It's a very unusual occurrence when both of those things happen.
Both of those things are true. Yeah, that's right. They're a monster as far as what they pay in terms of salary. There was some sort of astronomical figure, like over a three-year period, they paid over $412 million in payroll, which is insane.
That's $200 million over the cap. And the tax on that is $40 million or something like that. It's a huge number, it's not sustainable. No. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is, will this lead to the inevitable decline of the Dodgers because of the fact that they would have to divest themselves?
COVID is going to trim their, they're going to get a haircut. There's no question. And they're getting a haircut in both areas because there's no minor leagues to develop players.
Right.
And there's going to be no salary to pay players at the major league level. And this is the case, I think, for a lot of teams.
So speaking of COVID, apparently in the final game of the World Series, midway through the game, which this is a whole nother question, it was determined, and baseball contacted the Dodgers, that Justin Turner had tested positive for COVID, and he was immediately removed from the game. He was actually put into, under baseball's protocol, COVID protocol, put into an isolated room. And then something unbelievable happened.
Well, the Dodgers went on to win the game and win the World Series, and he came out and celebrated with his teammates.
Right.
Which is irresponsible, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, you cited that letter, that open letter about, you know, from the New York Times that really, I think, criticized him. I don't know, man. I feel bad for Turner in a lot of ways on this. And it's probably really difficult for him right now. But, you know, looking back, if I was him, I probably wouldn't have done what he had done. You know.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because it appears that you show some sympathy. I show zero sympathy. He still has not apologized for this. And further, if someone, God forbid, dies from this, then you need to face criminal charges. And I understand, and I know you want to be with your teammates. I understand they just won the World Series. Dude, you have something that could kill people. For you to sit out there in the team photo and to take your mask off next to Dave Roberts, a cancer survivor, is unconscionable. I understand. So, you know, we talked earlier this year about John Smoltz had made a comment prior to the start of the season that he felt as though this could be the most interesting season in baseball history. And throughout the course of the season, I think that proved to be true. And so ESPN has this article this week where it talks about how this was the best, worst, smartest, stupidest, and scariest season ever.
It was.
And I would have to agree, but I'm really, the reason why I cite this article is I'm very nervous about 2021. Here we are on November 1st, and we're at the worst peak of COVID possible. Is it possible that next year's season in April will start much like what just happened without any fans in the stands? And if that happens, then I think, you know, it's, and I think it could happen. I would have to say it's probably a 50-50 shot, maybe even better, that that's how the season starts out.
Yeah. And you know, these owners, there's no secret, the owners have lost billions of dollars, you know, in revenue from fans in the stands from all sorts of sources. So I don't know. It's going to be hard. Baseball's future is certainly an uncertain one. I don't know what's going to happen. And will we be doing a podcast about baseball next year?
That's well, I suppose I figure that we will. But, you know, as much as some things change and some things stay the same, one thing that's been happening in the last week is baseball is starting to hire managers that used to manage in the 80s. What is that all about?
Let's begin with, yeah, exactly. We'll begin with, there have been several manager moves, and the one that's closest to home is that the White Sox went and hired Tony La Russa, who managed them in the 80s, in the early 80s. And he took them to a division in 1983. He was fired by then general manager Hawk Harrelson, who was never accused of being one of the best general managers ever. La Russa goes on to win pennants and World Series with the A's and then with the Cardinals. And I think Jerry Reinsdorf, who owned the team then and now, you know, felt that that was a little unfair, that that was success that had been denied his club, that maybe if they had kept him. So instead of going out and hiring somebody maybe a little younger, maybe a little more analytically or inclined, maybe a little more connected to the modern game, maybe somebody who played recently, instead, the White Sox go back and rehire La Russa in a move that I – is leaving me scratching my head, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. And also, I followed on Twitter this week, the White Sox fans just absolutely exploded against this and made all very solid points. I don't understand this move at all. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago when it first started as a rumor. Didn't think it would happen. However, just like you said, this was a move out of nostalgia that Reinsdorf wanted to kind of right a wrong in his mind, which – again, he's the 83-year-old or 85-year-old guy that owns the team. He can do whatever he wants. However, the Sox are at a point right now that they need, in my opinion, a young manager to ride that out, because they're probably a couple of years away from winning the title, but they're not much more than that, and they could be less than that depending on some of the moves that they make in the offseason. This is a team that's ready, and it's not, you know, La Russa could do a fine job. You know, the only other guy,
he may win it all.
Exactly. The only other Hall of Famer manager that was a Hall of Famer and then became a manager of the team was Connie Mack. Yeah. And that's only because Connie Mack owned the team that he was able to come back, because he was, quite honestly, he had the most wins, he has the most losses, and it's a lot of losses.
We need more figures like that, owners who also manage.
So it's like Reinsdorf and La Russa all in one. And in this particular case, like you said, Tony is 73 or 75?
78.
He's 78.
He's 78. Well, and this is really the primary issue I have with it. And I'm not being ageist. I'm not being ageist, because when I think about La Russa, I know that mentally he's absolutely capable of making the decisions and running the team and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
From a mental point of view, I don't think he's lost anything. Correct. And certainly his career record as a manager, you know, is proof of that. The problem is he's an old man, and there's a lot of travel. You got to get on a plane for 81 games a year.
That's true.
In a pandemic.
Right.
Is this something – I was really surprised that he agreed to do this. I hope, I pray that he has the energy and the will and the physical strength to keep up with the demands that are going to be put upon him. You know, that is the issue. And the other issue is he's not going to be doing this for much longer. No, can you see him doing this beyond even a single year, Tom?
Well, maybe three at the most. But no. I think that to me, that may be the biggest issue of all is that this is just a bridge hire for a young team. Well, you just had your bridge hire with Renteria. You don't need another manager for different reasons. I have no doubts that Tony La Russa has the command of the game and is mentally all there and is bilingual, right, and all of those things.
Yes. He can do all that he needs to do.
I would have gone out and tried to find a young George Sparky Anderson and who was given a chance in his early 30s, even though he looked like he was in his early 50s. He was in his early 30s and he grew with the team that became the Big Red Machine. And that's
kind of like what you did with La Russa back in the 80s.
Right. Right.
I make the same kind of hire.
Right.
You know, I mean, La Russa's already in a Hall of Fame. You have nothing. You can't give him anything that he doesn't already have except for a world championship with your club. And you've got basically 1 year to do it. Now,
it was a lazy hire. It's lazy. It's easy to do.
I think that what's also interesting, though, is there is, I think, the hire does give the White Sox fan a cause for optimism. And that's because Reinsdorf is now going to have to, I think, really spend money and acquire free agents, especially pitchers, okay, in order to ensure that La Russa can succeed with this club. He cannot give La Russa the same club he gave Renteria. They only had two starting pitchers.
Yes.
You know, you have to be able to, you know, there has to be a better team if you're going to expect him to win. Otherwise, what are you really doing? Because you're going to be hiring a new manager in 2 years or less, you know.
You would think that La Russa would have made that part of the deal to say, hey, we have a common understanding. Kind of like if I was Joe Madden when I went to the Angels, I would have said, hey, we're not just going to sit on our hands year after year, right? Yeah. You know, or something to that nature. So it's perplexing, but it's not. I feel bad for, even though I dislike the White Sox immensely, I feel bad for their fans because they actually deserve better. This is a hell of a shell of a team. And really what it needs is a decent GM. Not sure that Hahn's the guy.
Hahn was overruled. He was overruled. He didn't want to. You don't think that Hahn woke up and said, okay, so now I just fired Renteria.
Yeah.
I put together this great team. I've acquired all this talent. I convinced the owner to rebuild. Now I think I'll hire the guy that was fired in 1983. You know what I mean?
He didn't make
that decision. There's no way. You know,
it's just perplexing until he wins. And then if he wins, I think people will be more forgiving. But no matter what, I don't see him, like you said, if he's 78, I don't see him managing in his 80s on the team. So it's a short time hire. I don't really get it.
Maybe we'll be wrong. Maybe he'll be in the dugout for another 10. I don't know. But I just don't think it's good long term. But on the other hand, it won't be for very long anyway. So Hahn will be able to hire his guy, and these guys will be reaching their prime. So maybe they'll get lucky. It's a roll of the dice. But
because Hahn, I know, is and La Russa hit it off very well, because La Russa, I was talking to him about reverse mortgages.
And also, you know, Herm Schneider's going to have to keep, you know, the trainer's room stocked with Depends and Geritol.
Oh, yeah. All that stuff is at place. And he's got his life alert in case he's fallen and he can't get up.
Okay. There, by the grace of God, go the two of us. So, but because the White Sox moved on La Russa, that presented an opportunity to your hometown team, the Detroit Tigers, who went ahead and hired A.J. Hinch.
Yeah,
now, the question I have for you, Mr. Longtime Tiger fan, does some of the stink of the Astros scandal, a scandal that you've been bitterly critical of, some of that kind of come with Hinch?
First of all, I do not like this hire at all. I would never have hired Hinch. Any of those guys that were messed up in that scandal, I wouldn't have hired. That's just me personally. Interesting, Hinch played for Detroit in 2003 when the Tigers lost almost the most amount of games of all time. And he was basically a 200 hitter. So I don't I don't like this hire, and for the simple reason that I think that there's got to be a lot of young managers in the minor league system going, what's wrong? Am I ever going to get a chance? Are they just going to keep rehashing, you know, these old things over and over again? I hope it works out for the Tigers and Hinch. I'm not a fan of this move.
Well, you know, my question though really was, does the stink of the scandal come with him?
Wherever he goes. It's on his wiki page. It's wherever he goes, it will be there. Yes. Yes, it does.
Especially here because he's bringing in Carlos Beltran to be his best.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know. And Pete Rose is going to be, you know, their on-field coach.
But Jeff Luhnow, now he could be the ball boy.
Yeah.
You know, would you like that?
No,
I don't think it's a good move either. I would have liked to have seen somebody else. Unlike you, I need a reason to sort of like the Tigers and be interested in them. And this is not, this doesn't help.
Okay? Right. Correct. That's a good point.
And then that also brings us to the next sort of managerial opening is Ron Renick. He retired from the Red Sox, they may be bringing back Alex Cora, who was suspended for a year, also due to the Houston Astros sign-stealing bullshit. You know, what do you think of this?
I think this was predestined at the beginning. I think this was part of the deal. That Renicki took to manage, knowing full well that he'd be out after a year.
And Renicki took this, Cora knew it. Everybody knew it.
This stinks for me on Cora, on Hinch and Luhnow and anybody else that was suspended, because you weren't suspended for a full year. You were suspended for 60 games. To me, they should have to do the full year.
They should have to do the full one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You got way too much time off for good behavior, so to speak. So this just stinks, this move. People don't care about morality anymore. It's all about business and results.
You're right. You're absolutely right. All right. So speaking of business, a very big businessman by the name of Steve Cohen bought the New York Mets, and Major League Baseball, the owners committee or whatever, approved the sale.
Yep.
Now, my big question to you is, do you think that he makes them a better team?
Absolutely. Everything that Cohen has touched, even though some of it is tainted, as we previously discussed, has been to a certain level successful because he's a pretty driven guy. Right. And I would think that where the Wilpons were considered, kind of idiots in many of the things,
they didn't like paying big money for free agents for a team like that.
Cohen immediately becomes the wealthiest owner in baseball, and I think he could very well act like it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to spend the most. I don't really mean it by that way. I think that they're going to look at the franchise the way that they should have all along. They got Sandy Alderson, who has a lot of respect in baseball, to kind of run the baseball operations part. That already was a first good, safe move as he kind of gets his feet wet in Major League Baseball. But I would anticipate Cohen to be a very active, progressive owner that will spend his money to win a World Series for the Mets and their fans, their long-suffering fans.
Well, they deserve it. I mean, because we were talking about the organizational investment that the Dodgers made to win the World Series. You know, the Mets should be like the Dodgers. They should be like the Yankees. They should be like the Red Sox. They should be like the Cubs. The Cubs should be like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. The Cubs should have a great farm system and a high payroll. So hopefully he'll bring that to Mets fans. I've always liked the Mets a little more than the Yankees. Always sort of pushed for them to win more than the other.
Yeah, me too.
I've
outright rooted for the Mets. I rooted for them in '86 against Boston. I wanted the Mets to win the World Series.
It's impossible to root for the Red Sox unless you're from Boston.
Cohen will have his work cut out for him. But I think that if they put the right plan in place, the Yankees are so for so long, the Yankees have been the only competitive game in town until the 2010s, till the Mets actually went to the World Series. They're not that horrible. And they have, in Jacob DeGrom, one of baseball's best starting pitchers. So they have a lot to build on. And what's his name that hit all the home runs as a rookie is a Met.
That's right.
So they've got a good future.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, I threw in this article about looking at sports owners' political donations. And the reason why I did that was I just was astounded at that, not just how much Republicans spend, but how much money is spent in baseball, period, versus the other sports. I was shocked to see that.
How much money they're spending on political, so both parties, I assume.
Yeah, both parties, but the overwhelming majority is Republican, which is to be expected. But what stood out was just the amount of money that is contributed to baseball.
Well, that's the thing that's always kind of confounded me about the very, very wealthy, how much money they will spend in order to avoid spending more money. I don't know. It just seems to me that you're still going to have to pay taxes on one way or another, whether they're taxed at a higher or lower rate, depends maybe on who's in power. But is it really a good idea to spend all this money and contribute all this money that you, I don't know, it just seems like you're just moving money around in the end. Better let the government have it.
It's interesting. Like, one of the biggest contributors is Ricketts.
They've been big Trump supporters.
And well, it's not just being a Trump supporter, but I'm saying they're contributing to political campaigns. It's just odd to me the disparity between the other sports. If you would have put a gun to my head, I would have said it's got to be the NFL. It's not the NFL at all. It's not even close. It's Major League Baseball.
Maybe it's because Congress kind of controls things that Major League Baseball needs. You know, they need the antitrust designation. There's certain sort of statuses that they have to have and that they need to perhaps contribute politically in order to maintain them. I don't know. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But what about DJ LeMahieu? Now, this guy, okay, I want to talk about DJ LeMahieu, who is a free agent this year. This is the second baseman for the Yankees, one of the best hitters in baseball, makes contact, puts the ball all over the field. In fact, he puts it all over the field to such a degree that teams just have, they don't shift on him, which I thought was astounding.
You know? Yeah. It's he was a Cub. He's a second baseman, which is a position we desperately need. And so, you know,
I think he's going to be back here.
Well, I would make a strong play at him because he's a real student of the game. If you know anything about him, you'll see that he has really worked on his craft over the last 3 years, maybe as well as anybody in baseball, the amount of time that he puts into it. So I saw that
the only guy who really consistently stays inside the ball. You know what I mean? Where he keeps his hands inside the ball and commits to hitting the ball to right field, you know, as a right-handed hitter, and he's great at it.
He reminds me of a younger version of can't think of the guy's name. Who's the first baseman on the Reds?
Oh, Joey Votto.
He reminds me of a young Joey Votto, even though LeMahieu is not that young anymore. But in his baseball career, I mean, Votto was like that too.
No, he was, and he's a good defensive player. I mean, he would look good in a Cubs uniform again. I think it's
sure.
The thing is, he would not hit for as much power as he's hitting for the Yankees because in Yankee Stadium, you have that short right field porch, and he was very good at hitting those sharp line drives that just got over the fence, low fence in right field, that low short, you know, so we wouldn't see him hitting 20 home runs, but hopefully he's the kind of hitter that the Cubs really need to have. Somebody who makes contact and gets on base.
The Cubs need to do one of two things, because either move Baez back there and go get Iglesias, who's a free agent out there, who had a pretty big win above replacement, and let him play short. They need to do something there now that Kipnis is gone. And I'm not so sure that Nico is the answer. That's all.
Now, did you see this bit about scoreboard watching in San Diego at Petco Park? They have this guy named Jeff Prott who runs the scoreboard in Petco Park. And what they do is, what he does is he acquires information about players. He gets little facts. And sometimes and he does this for every player in the majors. And he has at least 10 to 20 little bits of information, like loves to play with drones or just little silly stuff.
Yeah.
And he piles them, and then when these players come to town, he flashes them on the screen. And I think this is great.
Yeah, baseball's always had a variation of this, because I remember when I was a kid, Ernie Harwell used to say, like, if a ball was hit to a certain area of the stands, Ernie would say, "Hey, that's a young man from Wixom that caught that ball." And yeah, he didn't know if he was from Wixom. He just would make it up right there on the spot. And it, to me, this is a variation of that, except that Jeff Pratt actually keeps a little tidbit. He's got like 30 little Word docs on his desktop of his computer that as tidbits about certain teams become known, he adds them with the express purpose of using them later in the games.
And he's not doing anything sinister. I mean, he's just
media
guides. He's looking at, you know, old articles and things like that. He's talking to their friends, you know, and I love this because like when we used to go to White Sox games, they would put little things on the scoreboard like that would be, they were so awful. We'd make fun of them. It would be like, he went 6-for-17 in Charlotte with 3 doubles and 2 home runs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm like, what are you telling me that for? You
might have
told me, you know, he has great penmanship, where he calls his mom every Sunday.
Something like, you know, he's afraid of clowns. Like, well, that kind of information.
Yeah, that's what Pratt is doing. There was a Korean player, and he puts up there that the Korean player, I forget his name, but he was saying that he lived in a house that had ghosts or whatever, or spirits from the past were contacting him. You know, so I thought that was kind of fun. So that anything that makes the game fun, I'm in favor of.
I'm with you. You know, the Cubs, because everything is not digital so much out there, even though they've embraced it, they still have a guy that puts up the numbers on that scoreboard. And that's an interesting thing because you don't want to be anywhere near his workspace like in the dog days of summer. It's pretty hot.
Yeah. I've been up there, you know, when the Cubs took a tour. I mean, that is not going to be a pleasant place to work.
No.
And I'm glad that we still do that at Wrigley Field, you know?
I am too.
Although that scoreboard is completely inadequate. They need to, you know, but anyway.
Speaking of the Cubs.
Now, the Cubs have done as expected. They've declined John Lester's $25 million option for 2021, although he said that he is still hopeful to be back with the Cubs next year. He did even go so far as to pay for fans, I think some 50,000 fans, to get a Miller Lite. Yeah. You know, at a bar or something.
Yeah.
So, which in the event that he may not be back, which I thought was kind of a classy move, but I think he hopes to be back. He's 7 wins shy of 200 for his career. Do you bring him back?
Yeah, at a reduced price, sure. But I don't think he will be back. And I think that was a tell. The buying of the beer was a tell. That was his way of saying farewell. Because if you think about it, there's one team that needs John Lester, and that's the Atlanta Braves.
Really?
That's where he's from, that area. And
he's from Seattle, I thought. No, and then or Texas, I don't know.
Or he lives there now or something like that. I'm not sure. But I just think if you look at the Braves and what their shortcomings are, they need John Lester more than the Cubs do. They may be willing to pay him more than the Cubs will. So it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. But as it appears now, I would have to say I would think the odds favor him not staying. I hope he does. I like the guy. He's a gamer.
I'd like to see him get his 200th win.
Me too.
But I think also there's something to be said for the Cubs having to kind of move on. They need to move on from this team, and as much respect and as much, you know, he was really productive, you know, as a free agent. He's probably the most productive free agent the Cubs ever signed.
He's an all-time Cub great.
Yeah,
and you know, while he probably won't make the Hall of Fame, he's been a gamer. And the thing that you love about a John Lester is he not only meets the occasion that he's faced with, but he steps it up a notch. He can't throw to first base. That's the worst thing I could ever say
when has he really paid for that inability?
Because he doesn't have to deal with runners. That's just it.
That's what you admire. You admire the fact that you're like, oh, you worry. What's going to happen when runners get on? They're just going to steal on him.
Right.
It never happened really that much.
It never did. I would love to have him back. I do think the Braves are a better fit for him. So we'll see what happens.
I think you're probably right. And if he goes to the Braves, he'll probably be very, very successful. So I wish him well. Exactly. All right. So now, but this is also indicative of the fact that there's just going to be massive changes for the Cubs this year. And it's going to be hard to predict exactly what all of them are going to be.
So, you know? So before we break that down a little bit, the Cubs did pick up Rizzo's option. So
they did pick up Rizzo's option. Good.
Yeah, so the 16
should have, they should.
I think they should have reduced the pay. He's going to get another $16 million. That's a lot of money for what Rizzo brings to the party.
What does he bring to the party? I'll tell you what he brings to
the
party.
He's a great defensive player.
He's the best defensive first baseman they've ever had, okay? He's a leader. He keeps the clubhouse loose. And I think he's a quality offensive player. I think you have to throw this year out, Tom. I don't think you can look at what he did this year and point to him and say, that's who Anthony Rizzo is.
Yeah.
You know, because he's, I think, very productive offensively.
Actually, his hitting woes actually go back a season before that. But generally speaking, it's you know, you could throw this year out. And I hope, you know, I'm a Cubs fan. I hope for the best. I agree with you. He's a tremendous defensive player. But I personally, from a financial standpoint, his lack of offense makes him about a $7.5 million player, not 16 and a half.
Well, the thing is, though, I can afford to be sympathetic as long as it's somebody else's money. I mean, I don't have fiduciary commitment to the Cubs. I don't give a shit whether they make money or not.
No, but I do keep a close eye on it because of what they have to deal with, not just under Theo's regime, but after Theo leaves. I mean, there's all these factors. But a lot of Cubs, and that's what I wanted to kind of maybe talk about for a second, probably are not going to be back.
No,
and we've addressed this before, who we think these are. But immediately the Cubs declined Descalso.
Yeah, well, they had to. There's no – I mean, the guy wasn't doing anything. I mean, what are you going to do? They were paying him what? They weren't paying him over 10, were they? I think they only had to buy him out for $1 million, but they weren't paying him more than $10 million a year, I don't think. Anyway, but it's good that they got rid of him.
But now, you know, then there becomes the issue of Tyler Chatwood, Jose Quintana, Jason Kipnis, you know, and then,
gone,
of course, are they going to –
gone.
And then, you know, the more pressing ones is, what do you do with Schwarber and Chris Bryant? And more so on Chris Bryant, Schwarbs, I think you keep, because if the DH stays in the National League, you have to keep Schwarber. You absolutely have to keep him. Even though he's earned his right to play left field, because he's actually one of the more average left fielders now, even though he was one of the worst. Kudos to him for working on his defensive game. But he really needs to be a DH, in all honesty. And I think, or have the ability to be a DH sometimes, from a power standpoint. Because otherwise, then I'm not so sure that you do keep him ultimately. Bryant, I think you have to trade Chris Bryant. And they probably should have gotten there was a lot of discussion about trading him straight up for Arenado last year.
They should have done it.
Oh my God. We were advocating, believe me, that's like a dream. And even though Arenado had a bad year this year, he still has
a dream.
Yes. And with him and Baez on that team. Oh man.
Yeah.
So,
I like Chris Bryant, and I think Chris Bryant is good. I think they should keep him, but how are they going to be able to afford to,
Well, so here's the reason why I think they have to do something like that is because 538, which was breaking down the season, saw two huge outliers, and that is two teams that made the playoffs with subpar hitting, subpar batting. One was the Reds, which we've discussed, and the other was the Cubs.
They were
statistically, neither of those teams should have made the playoffs because of their hitting. And I thought to myself, well, if it was 162 games, probably both of them wouldn't have.
They probably don't do it.
I think the Cubs would have faded and faded and faded. And the
Cubs
Reds
won the division. That's what's hilarious. That's
right.
That they came out on the strength of the first 16 games.
That's right.
Rode that to the division.
That's exactly right. So, of course, they have to make massive changes because they must improve that offense. I'm just nervous because of the money. You know, if they can't put butts in the seats at the beginning of next year, at what point do you start to see all things coming down, salaries, everything, you know?
Well, I did want to say one other thing about that article you sent me. I was really pissed off at the guy who wrote it. I'm not going to say his name, but he used that cliche of that I've just heard 1,000 times this year alone, is that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. That is probably, if I hear that expression one more time, I think I may scream. So.
Yeah, I believe me, I'm with you. There's ones I hear on business that are like, Like in the early aughts, people used to say, at the end of the day, I'm like, if you say that.
You still say
Yeah. And so what I used to say in meetings, they would say, at the end of the day, and I'm like, yeah, it's 11:59.
Yeah, it's 11:59, pal. Yeah, you're right. It really is. And there are certain things that just become a part of our collective sort of vocabulary. And I hate it.
And so one word that is part of our collective vocabulary is the word paparazzi.
Paparazzi. And that brings us to our popcorn discussion. And Tom chose this week La Dolce Vita, which is a film by Federico Fellini. It was made in the 60s.
It was filmed in like 58 and 59, released in early 1960.
And, you know, this is a movie I saw a long time ago when I was a kid. My father used to run this film society, and he'd show movies like this. And I didn't understand it then. And I just recently watched it again in a chopped up sort of way. And I'm not sure I even at this age, at the age of 53, I'm not even sure I completely understand it, but I do have some thoughts. But I want to begin with why you chose this movie.
Well, it's 13th on my list of all time films. I too, like you, saw this movie in the I think around 1985 when I was like in my mid 20s, and just like what Ebert says in the article. You know, he saw this film like every 10 years and it represented a different film. And I felt exactly the same way. In 85, I was very optimistically observing this film, which is just to give our listener out there a thumbnail sketch. It is the story of this gossip writer in Italy.
Marcello.
Marcello Rubini or something like that. Marcello. And he is tasked along with other people in his newspaper and others, competitors, with following, you know, the second level celebrities, the fading movie stars,
the political
people that are having issues. And just every night he has to go out to the various cafes and places where they are in and around Rome and cover their exploits. And so the film is basically over seven nights and seven dawns and seven different stories, or seven different things that occur. Fellini was, before he started getting a little whacked in his directing later in the 60s with Armacord and some of these other films that were more, you know, they were almost fantasy. This is his first film that, there's a couple of scenes in this movie that will go down in motion picture history.
Well, there's the way
that he staged them, the staging of the scenes. But basically, to answer your question, it is about a tired gossip reporter, who's faced with some of the best parts of his job, such as seeing a lot of beautiful women, and he's kind of a little bit of a playboy to a certain extent. But the worst part is just the long nights, the hangovers, he's getting to that age where he's just had enough. And so me at my age seeing this film, I felt I saw the tired Marcello. When I was 26, I saw that, man, this guy's getting all the chicks. What is he doing? I gotta be like Marcello. But, and so my feeling like Ebert's completely changed when I saw it last night. And I just think it's a tremendous film. This was Roger Ebert's second favorite film of all time.
Well, you know, and that's an interesting point that you bring up, the exhaustion, because it's really about that. It's about a man who is exhausted with his life, with the lifestyle that he is forced to lead in order to do his job, that has him climbing all the stairs to the top of St. Peter's, chasing this actress, walking around in fountains with her, you know, staying up till 4 or 5 in the morning, not getting any sleep, covering, then off to some small town where the Virgin Mary has been seen by a couple of children.
Allegedly.
And then standing in the rain and just, how does he do it? I can't believe he didn't pass out from exhaustion, you know?
Well, I mean, I think the character starts to show that he is ultimately very tired with, and I think part of him almost is a longing to do something else. Meanwhile, everyone thinks that he has the greatest, sexiest job in the world. It's not the greatest. It's a lot of work. But there, you know, like again, like seven different vignettes. Ebert points out that someone said that it's the seven deadly sins. Ebert refuses to think of it in those terms because it would reduce it to basically a puzzle. And in his mind, it's basically these seven vignettes. And some are absolutely breathtaking. One of them features Anita Ekberg. And Anita Ekberg, at the time that she was introduced to America, was relatively unknown and became an enormous sex symbol. Enormous. Jeez. She was,
and rightly so.
She was a voluptuous, exactly. She was like a voluptuous Marilyn, even more voluptuous, cartoonish version of Marilyn Monroe.
Jessica Rabbit, you know.
and she plays it to the hilt brilliantly. And this is where Marcello Mastroianni, the actor, not the character, really shines as in the movie, is because he has this girlfriend that is extremely jealous, and he does everything he can to say, this is just my job, I'm just doing my job. And as soon as he sees Anita Ekberg, it's just like every other man in the world. All plans go out the window.
All plans go, I have to have you, I have to possess you. Right. But he never does. No. He intends to be unfaithful, yeah, but he never acts upon it.
Correct.
Which is interesting. You know, he's unfaithful in intention, but not in actuality. And that's what's kind of interesting. Scene of the Trevi Fountain is amazing. That's a great scene.
That's a, you know, one of those clips. It's one of the greatest, you know, scenes of all time. But the film is also known for the helicopter lowering the statue at the very first scene of the film, as far as from a trivia standpoint. So it has a lot of different things. This was a game changer, and for good, bad, or indifferent, it changed cinema. A lot of films were you know, directors, young auteurs, were extremely influenced by Fellini, and good, bad, or indifferent, it kind of imitated him. But there's only one La Dolce Vita.
There really is only one. And you know, what's also interesting is Fellini always used, you know, for the smaller parts, he used real Italians as extras. Right. Because he always felt that Italians were just natural actors, that they could do it. And they did. He would just put these guys in, and they would get one or two lines or something, have a little moment in the scene, and he would, and they would just be, these were not actors. These were not people who were professionally trained.
You know? There is one phenomenal bit of casting in the film, and that is one of the paramours of the Anita Ekberg character is played by Lex Barker, an American actor known for playing Tarzan in the 40s and the 50s.
That's right.
And for Fellini to kind of, that was a little bit of an in joke, a Hollywood in joke.
Yeah, right.
And the character Barker played was unfortunately similar to his own in real life, that he was, you know, he was this really great young actor that struggled in midlife, was kind of paralleled there in La Dolce Vita. Only thing that I would say to you, because of how you watched it, is that you know enough about language, and certainly Spanish language, that I think you should attempt to watch it again at some point, just in Italian without anything, and just watch the film.
Listen, I can understand, like, when they're speaking Italian, because I was really paying attention, attention to what they were saying, and then kind of with half an eye on the subtitle, really trying to parse out what it is they're saying. And I can get about 30 to 40% of it. I can't get enough of it to really get my head around it. You know what I mean? Really know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
It wasn't like the other film that we saw earlier this year that you got to see in Spanish.
Right. I got the Pan's Labyrinth.
Labyrinth.
El Labyrinto del Fauno.
And basically you reported that it was two different films. What I was seeing was not really what they were saying on the screen, which bothers me to no end, the fact that I'm that ignorant that I don't recognize that. And I suspected when I was watching La Dolce Vita the same thing, because
the Italian
language is so lyrical and it's so beautiful that it just seemed abrupt. And like I said, it was a word salad at the bottom of my screen. So
yeah, no, it was, it's hard to watch in that way. I need to see it with a good translation. I need to see it in a movie theater, and then I might have a better handle on it. But it was a good choice nonetheless. I'm glad, you know, we saw it. I'm glad we talked about it. I'm glad I saw Anita Ekberg. My God.
It stays with you. Anouk Ami is a beautiful woman in her own right,
yes,
who played Madalena. And even Yvonne Forneau, who played Emma, is a beautiful woman. That was the thing. They were all, men and the women, with the exception of Marcello's father, who has a memorable moment in the middle of the film, all right. were very attractive people. And that's kind of the allure of it as well.
And the Italians, I mean, there's a style to it. There's a style to the way the women dress, to the way the men dress. You know, Rome is an exciting place to be. You know, it's an international city. You see people coming in that film, you see people coming to Rome from all over the world, bringing their culture with them. They're playing jazz, they're playing rock and roll. You know, at first I thought this was a commentary on this sort of boorish behavior of Americans who are coming to Rome, sort of bullying them culturally and sort of defying and throwing away all of the conventions of Italian society, you know, going into fountains and drinking and dancing and, you know, behaving like idiots.
Right.
But it's not about that.
No.
But like an American, I have to think it's always about me.
So you know? This brings us to the end of our show and our season this year.
And our season. This is the last show of this season, of the 2020 season. We will be back, but not until 2021. We will be back in January for a hot stove discussion. And we'll probably talk about the Oscars a little bit as well in the popcorn segment. So until then, we are the two peas in a popcorn. In a two peas in a podcast. Have a good one.
Yeah.
I'll bang the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. Play the dead march as they carry me along. Put bunches of roses all over my coffin. Roses to deaden the clods as they fall.